This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03, Thursday afternoon, October 3rd. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. A home shopping channel is joining the pickleball craze. We'll learn more in our next segment, but right now, plans are in place to convert a struggling office building in downtown Chicago into an apartment complex. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, thank you for joining us today. And that seems to be the future, Drew, of these vintage office buildings in downtown Chicago, in the LaSalle Street Office Canyon and elsewhere, that maybe they don't have the floor layout to adapt to the modern office building, but they do look attractive to developers as condo conversion projects.
Absolutely, Rob. And again, thanks for having me. These buildings have been sitting vacant for a period of time. And I think this is a nice opportunity, because what's happening is the investors are able to buy these buildings at such a discount. So they're able to convert them into either apartments or condos. And that's bringing some excitement, I think, to the city, because, you know, we're looking for inventory. What a better, you know, opportunity to have some more inventory, but and use some of these older buildings.
Now, what is the challenge for developers to turn these old office buildings that may be obsolete from an office space standpoint into attractive properties that homeowners either want to rent or own?
It's a great question. I think right now the biggest obstacle that they'll have is really overcoming some of the city issues that are out there. Whether these buildings are in building code violations or they're in demo court, there's a lot of different liens and encumbrances that could be on these buildings that the investors are going to have to address and deal with. And then, you know, just getting the plans and permits through the city. It's going to be interesting to see if the city is going to help in cooperating with this new development project, because, you know, if they believe in it, they're going to certainly help and see it happen.
20 years ago, a number of neighborhoods that used to have a great deal of industrial property abandoned reinvented themselves and became very attractive places to live, because developers were able to turn old factories and old warehouses into really cool loft apartments or condos. Is this a similar situation, that not only can you make these old buildings, give them new life as residential buildings, but make them cool as well?
Oh, totally. I mean, you can't build the buildings that are in the city of Chicago right now. I mean, the cost to doing that the construction of yesteryear is something of the past. I mean, to recreate some of that stuff in today's day, in today's market, would be a fortune. So being able to revitalize the interior of these buildings and repurpose them to conversions of condos and apartments for living space, I mean, how awesome is it going to be to live in some of these iconic buildings, as well as, I mean, this is what New York did. New York did a very similar thing with converting some of their buildings and some of their old history, too.
And how could this potentially transform downtown Chicago? We already know that the Loop is one of the, if not the fastest growing neighborhood in Chicago, and a lot of people live there, and that really did hasten its economic recovery from work from home during COVID-19. But that, you know, the south end of the Loop, where all the LaSalle Street office buildings are located, which used to be the financial mm-hmm. center, not only of Chicago, but the entire Midwest, if you can turn some of those old buildings into apartments or condos, what does that do for the entire, for all of downtown Chicago?
I mean, it's just going to, you know, really, I think, you know, increase the exposure and the interest down there. I mean, you know, the Thompson Center is being renewed into Google buying that. Like, that's going to put a lot of people and a lot of want to be living close. So I think there's going to be an attraction down there, especially, you know, when this thing really starts to move around and they start to see what buildings they're redoing and how they're redoing these interiors and such. I think that's going to draw a lot of attention. I think there's going to be an interesting push to migrating back into the city. It'd be cool to see.
Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, QVC is looking to push more pickleball paddles. We'll talk about that next.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Shopping channel QVC is boosting its presence in streaming by becoming the exclusive broadcaster of USA Pickleball. Let's discuss the strategy with Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verterre Group in Chicago. Tim, thank you for joining us today. And it wasn't too long ago that QVC was the home of ladders. You could buy ladders that could reach really high ceilings in your home, or maybe some Star Trek collectible plates. But now it's a home to live sports.
Well, I can't speak to your shopping habits at home, Rob, but I will say it is really astonishing that two companies that you would not expect to be, leading the charge in innovation when it comes to media these days, and just how quickly everything is transforming and changing and all that. I mean, QVC, right, a relatively staid and long-serving home shopping channel, and one of the entities behind the fast growth of this thing called Pickleball, right, USA Pickleball, essentially the national organization behind its rise, coming together to actually mutually benefit each other, and frankly, evolving the media landscape in a very innovative and entrepreneurial way along to boot. I never would have seen this coming, but it's absolutely, I think, just short of brilliant.
Now, how is this going to work? You're channel surfing, you come across a pickleball game on QVC, and will there just be numerous windows or pieces of information telling you where you can buy every single thing that you find on the pickleball court?
Yeah, so there are a couple elements. Number one, QVC is getting their hands into sports programming, right? Which is, as we've talked about before, is just the probably the biggest crown jewel there is in, frankly, anything live television. So the ability to bring live and repeated sports programming on the air beyond just quote unquote shopping is a win for QVC and keeps them relevant in the media landscape. Number two, it's great for USA Pickleball because it gives them a go-to place for all of their major events, both on the television, which is over the air TV channels, as well as cable, fully penetrated in the United States, as well as on their QVC Plus streaming environment. And then when you put them together, the opportunity exists to embed commerce opportunities during and shouldering before and after the actual broadcasts with shopping, commerce opportunities, in-game opportunities for merchandise and that kind of stuff. So it's an elegant mutual benefit for the two of them, but also it's a frankly indicative of what we need to see more creatively in the media community right now to prop up, keep television alive and kicking and sports. It's a brilliant combination in my mind.
And that leads to an interesting question. That is, how is pickleball doing? Because a lot of entities have invested a great deal of money in it, either as a good use of open space, as a good way to get into sports broadcasting, as a good way to get into sports team ownership. Is this about making pickleball an entity, or is this about maybe practicing in a low-stakes environment before scaling this up to something like baseball, basketball, or football?
Yeah, look, there's no question that pickleball is very much a lifestyle as much as it is a sport, right? So that the handful of leagues that exist on the professional level, USA Pickleball at the sort of tournament level, but it's make no mistake, right? The 50 and older crowd in particular, which QVC, especially on the female side of things, tends to be focused on in terms of their target market. It's a perfect setting for that audience, for a sport that continues to grow in popularity with that target audience. So that's a nice added benefit, I think, for this partnership.
Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verterre Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, McDonald's looks to capitalize on one of its most recognized menu items.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Chicago-based McDonald's introducing a new Big Mac that doesn't include beef. Let's get the latest now from RJ Hodevy, head of analytical research at Los Altos, California-based foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. RJ, thank you. thank you for joining us today. Now, this new Big Mac is just swaps out some grilled chicken with panko crust in favor of the beef patty, and it has been extensively tested elsewhere, as in other countries.
It has. You're exactly right. So later this month, or I guess in November, we will see a test launch, at least a limited time launch, of the Chicken Big Mac. You're right. This has been very successful in other markets. It sold out in 10 days in the United Kingdom and did fairly well in a test launch in the Miami market a few years back as well. So it'd be interesting to see. Chicken has been something that McDonald's is pushing more aggressively into the last couple of years, and I think this is just the next step in that plan.
And part it seems like the Chicken Big Mac is also a shot fired at several, you know, chicken heavy chains like the Chick-fil-A's of the world and Cane's Chicken, which seems to be growing by leaps and bounds.
You're right, and that has been where a lot of the growth in the quick service restaurant category has come. It's from the chicken sandwich places, the, you know, Chick-fil-A's, Raising Cane's, but also some of the hot chicken concepts like Dave's Hot Chicken as well. So that's been where a lot of the growth is, and you know, our visitation data really supports that. And so I think that's another reason for this, is to be into that, push into this category more aggressively. The other thing too is, typically speaking, chicken is less costly than beef on the menu as well. So this is also a cost saving move in addition to generating some new interest as well.
What's also interesting is part of the product rollout. It had some success in the United Kingdom. It did have that product test in Miami 2 years ago. But one other element of this rollout was at a pop-up restaurant in Los Angeles. They called it McDonald's, and the people who were dining at McDonald's didn't know it was actually from McDonald's.
Yeah, it's exactly. We've had this discussion before. Some of the innovative ways to get product awareness and test new products. You know, QSR companies are doing a lot of innovative things on that front. So, again, some more data, some more validation for the launch of this product. And if I was betting, I think this will do pretty well, at least out of the gate. So we'll see if it becomes a full time feature, or at least comes back every year. But I think I'm guessing that this will be successful early on.
RJ Hadavi, head of analytical research at the Los Altos, California-based foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. Thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, we'll tell you about a robot that's helping sick kids attend school.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. First responders from Illinois are helping save lives in hurricane-ravaged areas of the Southeast. President Biden weighs in on the possible retaliations by opposing forces in the Middle East. In Technology Thursday, we learn about a robot that can help young students feel like they're in the classroom, even when they can't be. And the strike by port workers on the East and Gulf Coast is prompting some people to panic buy toilet paper. WBBM Business, the markets are lower. The Dow is down 280 points. The NASDAQ down 41. The S&P 500 down 21. 74 degrees right now in Chicago under mostly sunny skies. Going up to 80 today. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. The massive trail of destruction left behind by Hurricane Helene is overwhelming, but North Carolina getting some help from crews outside the state, including Illinois Water Rescue 1, which is led by Ken Shulman and has a team of first responders from the Chicago area. CBS Chicago reporter Charlie DeMar with more.
Shulman says his team recently came across a secluded neighborhood of about 300 people.
We've been going into some areas that no one can get to.
They were the first emergency crew residents had seen since the storm hit.
Some of them had felt like they were either so cut off or had been ignored. And to see us show up, there were a few spots where we literally received hero's welcomes of people clapping us up.
While the floodwaters may have lowered, the sense of desperation is rising for those who live in hard-hit North Carolina.
The firefighters are part of the Mutual Aid Box Alarm System, which provides assistance around Illinois and other states in times of critical emergencies. President Biden says he would not support retaliatory Israeli strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. The remarks come as the Middle East waits to see how Israel will respond to Tuesday's massive missile attack. Meanwhile, Israeli forces are continuing their offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. All of this happening as the Jewish holiday kicks off. The latest from CBS reporter Haley Ott in Tel Aviv.
Lebanon seems to be escalating. There's expectations that Israel will retaliate for Iran's missile barrage earlier this week. So the conflict seems to be moving further and further away from the concerns of these families of the hostages, which is to come up with some sort of ceasefire deal that would see their family members released.
It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are lower. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Ryan Dietrich, Chief Market Strategist with the Carson Group in Omaha, Nebraska. Ryan, thank you for joining us today. And how much is this latest tension in the Middle East, how much is that weighing on the markets? And when, potentially, could investors sound the all clear?
Well, thanks for having me back. Good afternoon. And boy, this is the October surprises we were worried about, right? But you talk about just, you know, the Middle East. I mean, listen, obviously the war is escalating. No one truly knows how bad it could get. The big worry, of course, is if it gets into different regions and different countries get involved. We're optimistic that's not going to be the case. Let's be honest. You know, October 7th was about a year ago. Stocks are up 30% since then. So by no means are we minimizing what's going on. But the honest truth, Rob, we've seen, you know, geopolitical concerns before. And if the U.S. economy remains strong, that tends to suggest, again, that, you know, stock market very well can go higher in the midst of, honestly, some just terrible, terrible headlines.
And is this also a case, too, of you had a great deal, you know, the bull run continued in the month of September, and that maybe investors are catching their breath and seeing if they can continue to climb that mountain in the month of October before they continue to do so?
Exactly. You know, the S&P 500 is up 5 months in a row. It's up 10 of the last 11 months. This was the best start to any year going into October since 1997. I can go on and on, but it's been a heck of a run. I'll just put it this way. October is known for some spectacular crashes, 1929, 87, and 2008 specifically. All in all, it's about an average month, but it does, when it's down, it can be really down. Now, here's something to think about. When you're up 20% for the year on the S&P going into October, like we are this year, like we were this year, October actually is down 3% on average, and higher only 2 out of 9 times. So again, that's not the end of the world, but when you have a big move for the start of the year and then you have October, you could have some indigestion. Now, let's take one more step to this, though. Historically, when you're up a lot like that, the fourth quarter is really strong. So what does it tell us? Maybe you take a break a little bit in the month of October, perfectly normal. But once you get through the election and the uncertainty around the election, we fully expect the stock market's probably going to have, you know, several more percent to itself here and still make some new all-time highs when all is said and done.
Also, how much uncertainty does exist around the election? I mean, this, you set aside all of the rhetoric that we're hearing. I mean, you have one candidate who was the president, and his economic policies are a known quantity, and you would know what he would do if he got into office from an economic perspective. You have Kamala Harris, who is the vice president of the current administration, and you know their economic policy, and that's a known quantity. And it seems like the X factor is, does the president get a Congress that does what he or she wants? And you can make policy judgments and make policy bets from there.
Well, exactly. And you're right. I mean, listen, there is still some uncertainty, obviously, but we do have a pretty good feeling of what we might get for the next 4 years, depending on who wins. So I was going to go that route. You know, historically, when you have a split Congress like we do right now, the S&P, this is pretty interesting stat, S&P has been up 13 years in a row when you have a split Congress. This year is going to be probably 14, unless we have a massive, let's just put it this way. Let's hope this year is 14 as much as we're up. So when all is said and done, we wouldn't be surprised at all if we still have a split Congress when everything's done, you know, in November, well, November 5th, come in November 6th, and hopefully we get the results, I guess, November 6th. But if we still have a split Congress, that's at checks and balances, not too much power one way or the other. Markets don't like when you have a major red wave or major blue wave, because, again, you can have too much spending and you can just push everything out. Honestly, that's what checks and balances are for, what our forefathers wanted, you know, 200 and something years ago. And we think that's still probably going to be the case, a split Congress, which was what should, honestly, most investors should be rooting for when that election happens.
I was going to say, Ryan, it's kind of wild to think about. We're just 2 years away from 250 from America turning 250. So just think about all the hype that surrounded the bicentennial in the 1970s. So we got to get going on that. We got to bring back the tall ships or whatever they did in 1976.
You know, I was afraid you were going to say in 2 years we have to do midterm elections. Do it all again. That's where you go with that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the bottom line, I'll just wrap it up like this. Earnings continue to hit all-time highs. The Fed, obviously, is now in a dovish phase, meaning they're going to start cutting rates. The economy is wobbling, yes, but not going into a recession. You know, there's still worries, sure, but overall what's got us here, Rob, to over 40 new highs in the S&P this year is still there. We still think it's a bull market.
Ryan Dietrich, Chief Market Strategist with the Carson Group in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you for joining us today.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday. When young students are unable to attend school due to chronic illness, separation from the classroom and their friends can take a big toll. Now there's a way to help them feel more included. We're joined by Chris Stegg, Chief Technology Officer with eGroup in Chicago, author of the new book, Elevate the Enterprise. Find it on Amazon. Chris, thank you for joining us today. The robot basically goes to school for you, and you, as the patient, can then experience your classroom through, it sounds like, telepresence.
Right. It's such a great story that changes students' lives, Rob. Thanks for having me on. It's a telepresence solution where a robot, there's various kinds in the market, can be implemented in the classroom, either at the desk of the absent student or on a table close to the blackboard. And then the student, through an app provided by the robot company, can move the robot's head, react with emojis that kids are familiar with, speak through their iPad or laptop to project their voice through the robot in the classroom. So it's an amazing way for them to continue their learning when they're out for a good period of time.
And this is not something, a future technology that we are discussing. This is real. And there are 3,000 active units in 17 countries, and they are in use in the UK and in Germany. And what has been the experience so far?
It's been amazing for the students and the parents. In fact, Rob, there's several companies making this. The one that you're speaking of is a Norwegian company, went in business in 2016 and has good traction in Europe. There's also a U.S. company that is making a similar solution called Double Robot, and its use cases include for junior high or high school students the ability to actually roll around in the hallways to get from class to class. So the experience for the students is amazing, and it's not just that they're learning. One student on their case studies finished head of their class, but you said it earlier where it's really keeping them in touch with their friends, and most students polled are saying that that's the most important thing, and we all know how they feel about the learning, but their friends are the more important piece. But it's great. The parents also really appreciate the fact that the students aren't missing and have that social connection as well.
We're talking with Chris Stegg, Chief Technology Officer of eGroup in Chicago, about this robot that can allow sick children to attend school. Obviously, there are the learning considerations, but you're bringing up something very important, and that is this robot can also help children fight loneliness and fight isolation that comes with being maybe in a hospital room or maybe homesick for extended periods of time. And could that robot then be used for other purposes for people who may be older who could be experiencing that same level of isolation?
Absolutely. Yes. I think the use case would be a little different there. We might see folks using these as social connections, using an AI interface, a ChatGPT voice, if you will, at home, or using it to easily connect to their friends or family through a video call, as opposed to the direct learning capacities of these student use cases. But yeah, there are very broad use cases available. And if you think about the difference here, it's not just a FaceTime or a Zoom call. It's actually an entity. Some of them will transmit their video, like the Double Robot that I mentioned. The AV1 that we're talking about here is not transmitting video because, frankly, kids in sick situations don't really want their video transmitted. So they have options.
And then very quickly, this is a convergence of a number of technologies that have been emerging over the course of decades. What did it take for this robot to to become practical? Was it just the ability to transmit images and data in a high quality manner over cellular signals that really, really brought this this technology, this robot, into fruition?
That helped. And I think the unfortunate pandemic helped people understand that this was a feasible use case. I think up until then, and these companies really only started in 2016, up until then, I think they're a real niche. Now I think it's a more commercially and academically accepted means to communicate. And I think we'll see growth in this area.
Chris Stegg, Chief Technology Officer with the E-Group in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, how a shortage of TP is the product of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The strike by port workers on the East and Gulf Coast has some people fearing shortages of some products, and as a result, they're panic buying items such as toilet paper. Let's talk about how shortages can sometimes be self-fulfilling with Bob Fibb, CEO of The Retail Doctor in New York. Find him online at theretaildoc.com. Bob, thank you for joining us today. And first off, let's just get this out of the way from the outset. Is there a toilet paper shortage?
There's no toilet paper shortage, my friend. You may wipe in peace.
Yes, I mean, and there are various levels of urgency when it comes to a potential toilet paper shortage. If there's one in your house in one particular room, it could be a real problem for you. But it's not the case at the store. But let's talk about how panic buying develops, Bob. Because every time there may be some unrest in some other part of the world, you see people run to the gas station thinking, "Well, I should probably fill up now before prices go up." And do we see, you know, what are some of the shades of panic buying in the retail space?
Well, it famously was the tulips back in the 1800s, right? Like, everybody had to have a tulip because they were scarce, and they led to incredible inflation and all sorts of things. But, you know, the port strike is real. You know, things are going to be delayed, but that really matters about perishable products like bananas. I mean, we get 100% of our bananas through ports, so that's a big deal. And it goes badly quickly, right? So that matters. But everybody's got this hangover from the pandemic, right?
And even then, I mean, I think that was a self-fulfilling prophecy. But there were a couple of other factors at play with the pandemic, because there were certain supply chain disruptions back then because you didn't know how to continue operating certain businesses or plants in a congregate setting while making sure everyone remained healthy. And you also had people who just wanted to limit their trips to the store. So when they did go to the big box store, they bought three or four of the giant containers of toilet paper because they didn't want to go back, and that kind of led to that shortage. But eventually, you know, thanks to, you know, I know in the case of Costco, they limited how much you could buy. They managed to regulate those supplies. So if you run a store, what are some things you can do to make sure to make sure you have a steady supply of stuff if there is panic buying or some type of supply chain disruption?
Well, I think you can certainly talk about it. Certainly doesn't hurt to mention it. What we're hearing is things are, you know, there's been some outages at, I guess, some Targets and places in New Jersey. But for the most part, I think you just got to talk to your customers. Let's face it, everybody, oh, my God, the sky is falling. We should do something, and just talk about it. You know, it's really going to affect most retailers. Not going to affect that much because they've been planning for this for an awful long time. They have most of their holiday stuff, and whatever they don't have, well, they're going to find a way around it. But I think as your retailer, you always will be talking to your customers, and, you know, whenever people start freaking out, like I live in upstate New York, well, you're there in Chicago, and when a big storm is talked about, everybody runs to the grocery store, and then they kind of forget about it. Well, I think just being able to have a conversation like you and I are, just remember, there is no toilet paper shortage. It doesn't go bad. And if you bought three or four or five or six of those in your house, you're going to have a long time to have to deal with it. So just buy what you need, and, you know, don't make it worse.
Bob Fibb, CEO of The Retail Doctor, thank you for joining us today.